since 1971.
It's 9 o'clock, and I want to rock. Chuck Roast, your host with the most. This is 101 FM, WRIF in Detroit. Let me get my little 45s out of their nightgowns. Oh!
The home of rock and roll throughout the 70s and into the 80s.
I'm Steve Costan here in the saddle now from 6 until 10 here on WRIF until we fall into the sun, at least. By the way, speaking of that live Seeger album, we played it back in its entirety this morning. You may have heard that on Ken Calvert's show.
Detroit's only real rock and roll radio station in the decade of the 90s.
And then I remember coming here and they had such a problem because it would rain and they'd be having some type of wild metal concert and the kids out on the hill would be picking up sod, throwing it. Oh, I remember. Oh, man. I almost got belted with one, but it was just enough dirt to ruin the beer I had just bought. I was furious.
If it rocks, it's on the riff in the early part of the 21st century.
The actual site they do it, Gobbler's Knob.
Oh, yeah, Gobbler's Knob.
Like Gobbler's that. Knob. Yep. Mm.
That's in Groundhog Day, the movie. Sounds like a porn name.
Yeah.
It's Gobbler's Knob.
It makes me uncomfortable. It's like moist. Yeah, I don't like it.
You don't like Gobbler's Knob?
No. Well, say it more.
For nearly 50 years, we are, have been, and continue to be 101 WRIF.
Welcome to the podcast, The History of WRIF. I am Mike Staff. I was a DJ on the Riff for 14 years, from 1992 to 2006, and it is my pleasure to be hosting this podcast in which we're talking to the people and the personalities that have made the Riff the Riff. And so far on the podcast, we've talked to Arthur P., Ken Calvert, JJ and the Morning Crew, Karen Savelli, Steve Costan, big names and big personalities that will always be synonymous with WRIF. You know, when we think of the Riff, we think of rock and roll, of course. We think fun and humor and really all things Detroit. But the Riff story simply would not be complete without talking to today's guest, Peter Werby. Peter is probably commercial radio's only self-described anarchist, atheist, and vegetarian. And he's most well-known to Riff listeners as the host of Night Call, which was commercial radio's longest-running live call-in talk show. Peter, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Well, thank you. And it's a pleasure to be in there with all those names, all those people. What memories, what a tradition. Incredible. And Mike, you were part of it.
Yeah, it's the 14 great years of my life for sure. And you know, Peter, Arthur P. gets the most credit for being on the air at the Riff the longest, almost 40 years. But the fact of the matter is, you were on Riff longer, weren't you?
Well, it's hard to do the math because I began in 1970 and ended in 2016. But I also took some stops along the way at WABX, W4. What are we missing? Wheels. Mm. And I came back. So I don't know. It's close. But I always did, I'm the original layabout. Whenever I worked full-time, which I did once in a while in my career, I was working at a high anxiety level and soon enough wound up back weekends and part-time and what have you. And that was always fine with me. And I loved, of course, the talk show.
Well, yeah, you like Arthur, you were both at Riff before it was even WRIF. 101.1 was right. WXYZ FM radio, and in 71 it changed the call letters to WRIF. I couldn't recall who was hired first. Do you know at XYZ? You were Art?
Oh, I'm sure I was. It was May of 1970 that I began.
And Dick Kernan hired you?
Dick Kernan hired me, the legendary Dick Kernan, one of the few, three men when I talk about who was important to me having the professional success and also the financial stability. Dick Kernan is right in there because, I mean, I was a layabout with a commensurate salary up until then, in the 60s and all that, you kind of get along. I don't know how we did, but we did. But WABX was the big rocker in town. And when WXYZ-FM went on the air, everybody that was, quote, hip, just held their nose. You know, who's this? And they had, I don't know if you've talked about this in previous sessions, but they had these, first they did Beatles and Stones. And it's all they played were Beatles and Stones. And they had it on a loop. And then they had some recorded guy, what was it? Not Dr. John. Brother John. Brother John, and then Kernan, in his wisdom, figured out, unless we get some local focus to this, no one is ever going to listen. So I worked, as I do today, talking about longevity, worked with the Fifth Estate, then was a newspaper, now it's a magazine 55 years later, but we had these different sections in the paper, youth news, labor news, kind of women's news. So Dick Kernan, was he paying us? I don't even know if he was paying us now that I think of it. But slotted us, both of a number of us in with those specialty shows. And Harvey Oshinsky, who began the Fifth Estate newspaper, began this talk show called Spare Change, which was, you know, that was somehow had some cachet to it back then rather than just a homeless guy on the street. It was hippies coming, hey, man, you got any spare change? So Harvey went on to be the news director at WABX, and he said, hey, Pete, you want to do it? And I said, sure. So I got all my rad buddies in there, and what do they say? The rest is hysteria.
Now, did you change the name right when Harvey left from Spare Change to Night Call? Was that you that did that right away?
Not right away. Harvey always stole names. The Fifth Estate was stolen from a coffee house, and Gaia bless, you know, Harvey and all that. He's a genius. And also Spare Change. So I had a contest. And the Fifth Estate, is that a common, it may be commonly known. There was a movie about, what's his name? Begins with an A, the WikiLeaks guy. I can't think of his name right now.
Assange?
Julian Assange.
Anyways, the French Revolution, real quickly, there were the three estates, the royalty, the clergy, the people. Someone during the 1920s said the press is so powerful, it's a fourth estate, one up. The Fifth Estate.
And there's the Fifth Estate.
So I had an on-air contest, and someone wrote in and said, how about Night Call?
Oh, really?
Sold, yeah.
Wow, great. Yeah. Great name, of course.
Sure, yeah.
Well, so the Fifth Estate, you started working at the Fifth Estate before WXYZ, and you were there kind of as a journalist, right?
I was there. Harvey Oshinsky began it in 1965. I joined it in 1966. God, that's so long ago. It makes me sound like I'm 80 years old.
Well, the Fifth Estate is interesting because as I recall the story, Russ Gibb, who was the founder of the Grandy Ballroom, he said that there was like this really cool kind of scene going on at the Fifth Estate. So when he wanted to start this new rock club, he wanted to get in touch with the hippies and the beatniks that kind of knew the pulse of rock and roll in Detroit. So he went to the Fifth Estate, and that's where he met John Sinclair and a lot of other people, and because he loved just the culture and the vibe that was going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was Sinclair that really tipped him wise to all the bands. Sinclair, this genius of music, of rock and roll, and of jazz, he was the one who told Russ Gibb everything he needed to know, plus some. Yeah.
When you took the show over from Harvey, did you guys share the same point of view? Like, was it a pretty seamless flow?
Pretty much so. I was always farther to the left than he was. I always say I'm so far left that I fell off the spectrum. It's funny you mention that about how I would just to provoke people, I would say, as you said, I'm an anarchist, atheist, vegetarian. And the lions would be silent. So, okay, you know, we'd have to get back on to some subject. But, you know, all of those categories are easily misunderstood, particularly these days with what's going on. You know, you say anarchists, oh, Werby's out breaking windows and starting fires. You know, well, not this time around.
Mm-hmm. What's going on right now, so our listeners know, in case they're listening to this podcast a little bit later, today is June 11, 2020. We're on kind of the heels of the COVID-19 thing. We're right in the middle of huge political strife with George Floyd just being horribly murdered by a cop. You know, I look back on the riots of 67. I wasn't born yet, but from what I've read about and learned about it, boy, It's got to feel like a lot of similarities to you, Peter.
Well, of course, the scope of destruction in 1967, huge swaths of the inner city neighborhoods were just burned to the ground. I mean, although now we get to see this, right, as it happens on CNN and Fox and MSNBC. But as bad as it was, an inappropriate response, well, I'm going to erase that and but inappropriate. I'll come back to explain why in just a second. The damage done in 1967 was so immense and over such a huge geographical area that there's no comparison. Also, what are good videos? People good visuals rather. People walking down the street with signs endlessly, or police stations burning and people running in and out of stores looting. And why I took it back about saying inappropriate, it's inappropriate what caused that response. We learned as kids, you can't say, well, he started it or something like that. But riots throughout history, we're talking about since the advent of cities 1,000 years ago or thousands of years ago, when people get angry, they riot. Mm-hmm. And, and a lot of time it's inappropriate. There were like draft riots in New York. Remember the Gangs of New York? Remember that movie? Mm-hmm. And the draft riots were aimed at black people, killing black people at that time. London in the mid-18th century, British troops killed 300 rioters, with army troops because, they were trying to burn down the Bank of London and all that. So to some extent, it's social vengeance or social social revenge. And you and I, we can sit there and think, well, that's not the appropriate way to do it. And, the optics are bad. And, if they want to get the message across, blah, blah, blah. But, people that are doing it are deaf to counsel. Mm. So the best thing to do is to create a society and communities where no one even thinks about doing that.
Do you recall what spurred the riots of 67? What was the genesis of that?
Police brutality.
Yeah, it's crazy how 53 years later, police's heavy-handed tactics haven't evolved.
I was driving out to one of these many demonstrations last Sunday, and somebody was playing on mainstream radio a cut from Martin Luther King Jr. About police brutality, and I'm thinking, oh, did he just record that yesterday?
Right.
So we'll see. We're going to see whether anything significant is altered. I mean, I just posted something in, it was in Los Angeles or actually in Hollywood. There was a demonstration, Black Lives Matter, 50,000 people. Now, I mean, can you imagine if 50,000 people were out in the streets saying, DJs suck, talk show hosts suck.
Right.
I mean, we think, man, what are we doing wrong here? I mean, how have we created such, social disapproval? I mean, on one hand, of course, we all depend on the police for our security and safety. And what, again, we have to do is create a social context where the poor don't act out the script that poor do all across the world, no matter their nationality, color, race, or whatever. If you have poor people, there's going to be violence, crime, addiction, drug trafficking, spousal and child abuse. It's not what causes people to be poor. It's a symptom. It's symptomatic of poverty. Hey, this sounds like I'm on. Hi, you're on the air. Mike from Trevor City, go ahead.
It sounds like night call.
Coming up.
Thankfully, most police are motivated by serving and protecting. But there's a percentage that function as the enforcers do on hockey teams. And they're the guys that routinely have the highest number of brutality complaints and lawsuits, to the extent that big cities have to tuck away in their budgets tens of millions of dollars to pay off these suits against these egregious acts. And also the majority of cops never even pull their gun out of their holster. Mm-hmm. The majority of police never even unbuckle their holster.
KeithHearsCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
This is the History of WRIF, the podcast.
We encourage you to vote on November 4th, but keep in mind that it's your First Amendment right to speak out on any issue you choose. Freedom of speech is the fundamental right of every American citizen.
Legendary personalities from Detroit's iconic WRIF.
We shouldn't forget that the right to vote is something many people who came before us fought hard to attain. We'll see at the polls in November, but we'll never shut up.
Here is Mike Staff and our special guest, Peter Werby.
I'm curious, Peter, do you think things are different now? Do you think this is going to make things different?
You would think so. I don't. It's hard to gauge, but from your visuals, and I've been mostly going out in the suburbs to things, and 2,000 people in Birmingham, the crowd, 99% white. Mostly everywhere I go, it's white people. It's white people saying, you know, acting out of moral indignation, you know, ethical outrage at this. Keeps going on the talk show. One of the people say, "Well, there's not a lot of police brutality." I said, "Google police violence, and go to videos." And,
right.
You know, you can say, "Well, you don't know the whole story. You didn't see what before." And I said, "Well, look at some of those, and you tell me, you know, what could have happened before that justifies it." I mean, can I swear on this? No.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, being shit kickers is what cops have always been since they were set up in the early 19th century. And you get, more thankfully, most police are motivated by serving and protecting. But there's a percentage that function as the enforcers do on hockey teams. And they're the guys that routinely have the highest number of brutality complaints and lawsuits, to the extent that big cities have to tuck away in their budgets tens of millions of dollars to pay off these egregious these suits against these egregious acts. And yet they and also the majority of cops never even pull their gun out of their holster. Mm-hmm. The majority of police never even unbuckle their holster because when something's going on, there they get Derek. You know, he loves to do it. You know, I mean, that's his gig. And you know, he's beating the crap out of them, and they're just standing back like this. And it's in the ethos of police. It's not like, you know, you think those three guys vacated their ethical responsibility. In an overall picture, they certainly did. I'm sure they didn't think he was killing them. I'm sure that Chauvin didn't think he was killing them. It was just this guy he knew from a bar where they were bouncers and figured, hey, you know, maybe this, well, I don't want to guess, but I don't know. Will it change? I don't know. I mean,
it seems like there's got to be something culturally broken inside of police departments, because for a guy to have 17 or 18 complaints like this against him, I think that the chief of police would be complicit. I wonder if the police unions would also be held in contempt because they don't allow cops like that to lose their job 17 or 18 times.
Yeah, I've been a member of Broadcasters Union all my life, and getting were you there when the RIF was union?
Yep, I sure was. Yep.
So you're going to be eligible for an after American Federation of Television Radio Artists pension.
Yeah, for sure I am. It's crazy.
You know that. Okay. I've told a couple people, they go, "I am." I go, "Yeah." So I've been a union man for that union all my life, and yet the cops don't even belong in the union movement. I mean, they can have associations or whatever, it's up to them. But yeah, they're one of the major impediments. Gee, the head of the police union in New York City, his name is Lynch.
Duff.
True story. And you know, he's the most ferocious defender of every act of brutality and killing that those cops have ever done. Well, you could say that's what the unions are supposed to do, defend their members. At one time, I almost got fired from RIF. In fact, they fired me. And the union filed a grievance and got me right back.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, I was trying to think of how many owners there there's been at RIFF throughout the years, at least a half a dozen, wouldn't you say?
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, now Beasley, Greater Media.
Great American.
Great American. American Broadcasting Company, ABC.
Yeah.
Five, and I think there's a couple.
There's a couple more. Does it surprise you, Peter, that the show, that Night Call, kind of withstood all those ownership changes, management changes, and everything?
Well, to some extent, yeah, because there is never, I shouldn't say never, that I know of, and this day, there is no left-wing regularly airing talk show on commercial radio. They're all on public stations, college stations, and what have you. Because, for instance, when I had a full-time talk show for 3 years, from 2000 to 2003, myself and Jolene Jordan were co-hosts. That was a network owned by the United Auto Workers, the UAW. And we had 16 stations, and we began right before the 2000 election, and after, you know, we just opened up on George Bush and called him a liar. And so we were premature Bush haters. And every time I would say something like that, we'd lose another station. You know, they were mostly small and medium cities, San Jose, California, and Santa Fe, New Mexico, places like that. And Chevy dealer owner would come in and say, whoa, you got this communist on the air. I'm pulling my ads if you keep him on. Boom. Well, you know, we were gone. I was down finally to one station.
Wow.
Let me go.
Wow. when you were at RIFF, did management ever come to you and say, hey, man, your views are too extreme. You got to settle down.
Never. They were. And it is a total accident of history and geography. It was Detroit and when WRIF started. And, of course, all the personalities that were in there then. An interesting thing that occurred, though, when we started, 1970, with all the personalities that were on the air and at the other rock stations as well, they were all, crazed. We were all crazed left-wing hippies, and the management were these really conservative people. And somewhere along the line, it actually flipped to the point where more DJs, the majority of DJs, were conservatives, and the management were these liberals.
Why do you suppose that happened?
You know what I think? These shock jock morning shows, except for Howard, who I was with at W4, Howard Stern, when he was there. But I've thought about that, and I really don't come up with it. And that's who is making the most money? Who is the most popular? The morning shows.
Right.
And these guys are getting... It was almost, because the whole ethos was liberal, they were rebellious. We're not going to be PC, we're going to, say this and I don't know. I'm not quite sure what occurred, but.
And it really is super interesting how, and the way you frame that is interesting too, how the long-haired hippie DJs used to be the liberals and the corporate people at the top were conservatives, and that flipped. Do you think the RIFF audience has kind of changed its political persuasion over the years? Like, in other words, you've had a lot of lovers and a lot of haters over the years.
I thought you were going to put some life there for a second. You've had a lot of lovers. I'm going, hey, dude, we're not going there. Okay. I'm sure I had a lot of people that loved the show, a lot of people that hated the show.
Right. Yeah, that's probably a fair way of putting it.
There you go.
Do you think that balance changed from the early 70s to maybe the last few years of the show?
It probably did. Well, I mean, the majority of WRIF listeners are the white working class, particularly the upper working class and the lower middle class, of which I would situate myself in. So I thought I was, talking to my brothers, most of them being young white men. And we've seen the demographics. I mean, since 1968, the majority of white people have always voted for the Republicans. And for some reason, it ramped up with Trump. I mean, it's a little hard for me to understand his appeal. A lot of people have, made attempts at explanations, and some of them are pretty good. But I think there was a change. And my show was ended in 2016, the Sunday before the election. And I'm sure if the new owners listened in, they probably heard 80% of the audience calling in and supporting Trump. Mm. And I thought, wait a minute, here is this, our guy, our employee, that's arguing with every one of them and even hanging up on a number of them. I think also they thought, the show originally, the only reason they had the show, as you know, because it had to meet the public service commitment of our license for the Federal Communications Commission, because my official position was the public affairs director of WRIF, responsible for programming. Well, when I began, there used to have to be hours and hours of it. I can't remember, religious programming and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like that. Well, by the time they someone said, "Weren't you angry at them?" I said, "Nah, it's their station, and I've had a long run, and who knows? Maybe they're even correct. I mean, my ego says no. Don't was I fired or terminated? Don't terminate me. In terms of an objective business decision, maybe it was okay. But they only, now I think they need 15 minutes a week. So I was getting a salary, not hourly, I was getting a salary. So they're paying a salary and benefits for shows that they didn't even really need in terms of the requirements. So, we were talking about the way it looks. So 80% of the audience is saying, well, Trump, blah, blah, it's good, he's great. And I'm arguing with them. And I would say, most people, if you get somebody on the air, I mean, how long, I won't even ask you about you, but, if you like Fox News, how long can you listen to MSNBC? And if you like MSNBC, how long can you listen to Fox News? And the same thing, if some guy is on there going, blah, blah, liberal, radical, lefty, blah, 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 you're going to go, F this guy. I'm going to switch to another music station, which I think was their concern. Because we're a rock station, and in the first three or four calls was all, hey, my buddy just died. Can you play Freebird?
Right.
And the phone screener would have to say, we're doing a talk show right now. I'll tell, Peter to tell the next DJ when it's over.
Coming up.
But then, since I was there at night, I pulled down my pants and Xeroxed my ass and put it at the star of the tree. So the general manager comes in, and I was told by the office staff, sees it, goes apoplectic, gets a chair, stands up, grabs it off and balls it up and says, "That goddamn Wormy."
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
This is the History of WRIF, the podcast.
12 o'clock and a full moon. Welcome to WRIF's Night Call. Peter Werby here for the next 3 hours. We're going to talk with a man who's been doing a lot to say no. Censorship doesn't have any part here in the United States, and freedom of expression should stay just that way, completely free. We're going to be talking with Frank Zappa.
Legendary personalities from Detroit's iconic WRIF.
That's really offensive to the American public, that they are so ignorant that they couldn't decide for themselves and need that kind of help. I mean, that's drastic. If you want your children to be that sheltered from what's really happening in the world, because remember, the songs don't make the reality. The songs reflect the time.
Here is Mike Staff and our special guest, Peter Werby.
I'm not sure if our audience understands how unique it is and how unheard of in commercial radio or commercial rock radio that there's going to be a talk show that is on every Sunday night. I wonder what do you suppose made Riff different or Detroit different, in which a show like yours would be embraced and supported by management and listeners for so long?
You know, this questions like that, I'm always supposed to come up with a really smart answer. And as I age, I increasingly answer things with, I don't know. When I said a little earlier, I thought it was just a coincidence of Detroit and of the station and the personalities. And the show became an institution. I did a full-time talk show. Did you know that? That it was a full-time. I forgot about that. Full-time on WRIF from 1972 to 1976.
Really?
This again was FCC-driven, Federal Communication Commission-driven, because they said, hey, look, all you guys are doing is selling beer ads and playing rock and roll, telling kids to kill themselves. You remember that was that whole reaction of politicians to rock and roll?
In the 80s with Suicide Solution, and that's when Dee Snider testified in front of Congress and so on and so forth.
But even before.
So
ABC, that owned the WRF at the time, said all over the network, the radio network, we were going to have a talk show. So it went from different times. It went from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. It went from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. And I was on 5 days a week. And, they were, so it became established. Oh, yeah. And then I never did get along real well with the management at that time. In fact, one of them, the program director, fired me. That's when I said I had a union grievance and got hired back. So you can imagine relationships weren't the best. And one of the things, I can tell stories like this. You can cut it out if you can. They, copy machines were relatively new, say in 1974, 1975. And the general manager said he wanted all the DJs to put their face on the glass, take a Xerox of it, and then they were going to post it and make a Christmas tree of it. It was at that time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I dutifully did one of my face, really disliking even the thought of what was going into my brain. But then, since I was there at night, I pulled down my pants and Xeroxed my ass and put it at the star of the tree. So the general manager comes in, and I was told by the office staff, sees it, goes apoplectic, gets a chair, stands up, grabs it off there, balls it up, and says, "That goddamn Werby." And someone said, "How do you know that's Werby?" He said, "Look at the hair all over the ass." what the hell does that mean? But then when that necessity of that FCC commitment to that much public service ended, that's where Tom Bender, the general manager, that's where he started as a religious programmer for the Detroit Council of Churches.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to do it anymore. And the general manager gleefully said, "You're fired," like that. And again, I was very stressed. And I said, why am I getting called into a meeting with a security guard here? So myself and my producer, what's her name? Diana Wing. That was a friend of Bender's, and he said, "The two of you are terminated." And both of us stood up spontaneously, and I'd never hugged her before, which I think is a good idea with station personnel. And we both were dancing around in a circle together. And I said, "All right, thanks, been fun." So
that's not the reaction he was expecting. That's for sure.
So then, though, they kept it on with, can't remember their names, with a woman who was very, very good, and then Mike Watson, who did the show. And then when our friend, who is the music consultant for WRIF and WCX.
Fred Jacobs,
yeah. He hired me back part-time on WRF in 1980 or 81, I think. And he said, "Hey, do the talk show again." And then it was unbroken till 2016.
I don't even recall you ever having guest hosts if you're on vacation or gone.
That's odd. That calls for memory, doesn't it? a couple of times we did when Doug Podell. Oh, I think there was a guy named Steve Black that did it once. He did. Can we get him in on this? Is this allowable?
Steve's a producer of this podcast. Yeah. Steve, you there?
Are you with us?
I can always edit me out, but
yes.
But yeah, I did it a couple times, Peter.
Oh, Jalene did it a number of times by herself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I remember. In fact, I used to urge her. She would have been good as a talk show host, because for a couple of times she did guest shots on like MSNBC and on CNN as, you know, guest commentators and what have you. But no, I would, I mean, you know how it is in radio. I always said since I did weekends, I could get 11 days off. I could leave on a Monday, be gone through that week, and then I had to be back by the next Saturday, no matter where on the planet I went.
That's a pretty easy gig, if you think about it.
Well, you know, I tell people I once or twice tried honest work, and terrible.
Hey, Peter, how do you think the internet changed the dynamics of Night Call? Like, suddenly you're being streamed all over the world instead of just being broadcast on Sunday nights in Detroit. Did that have an impact on you and kind of your mindset on the show when you're on the air?
Not my mindset. I mean, made finding out information a lot easier. There used to be a listener in Finland, up above the Arctic Circle, university town, Oulu, Finland. Mm. And he would call in through the internet every week almost. And I remember somebody called in one time and said, you know, you think your show's so great, you're just a nobody, you're a failure, you're a flop, you're just stuck away on this late Sunday night. If you're any good, you'd be on, you know, full time, and you'd be in the middle of the day. And I said, you know what, pal? In Oulu, Finland, I'm morning drive.
Right. That's awesome. Hey, how do you suppose social media changed the way that you could express your views?
Well, you know, a lot. I mean, more so almost since I've left. I mean, I used to do, you know, I had a website and a Facebook page and all that, but now it's so consuming of you know, and mixed with terrestrial radio. I mean, one of the things that I would usually do during my shifts, I don't know about you, but I'd read books. Mm-hmm. I would read the huge, you know, okay, magazines or books or the newspaper or yeah, what have you. And now these DJs are every minute. They're posting, you know, hey, I'm playing three from Led Zeppelin. What's your favorite? You know, do anybody remember when Led Zeppelin came to Detroit? Tell me about it, you know, and on and on. I mean, they are actually earning their money. I'm laughing because I'm not always sure I did, but
Well, it's really cool for a DJ to be able to connect with his audience that way, and for the audience to be able to connect together that way through social media. That wasn't possible. Do you think, Peter, that social media is a good thing or a bad thing, especially when it comes to political discourse?
You know, it's like every piece of technology. I mean, what would we do without our cars, right? How would we get around? What would we do? On the other hand, you know, millions of people have been killed by them since 1900. It necessitates oil. I mean, you know, so it's all, you know, the give and take. I mean, I'm an admin on a Facebook page for my neighborhood association, and I just had to, myself and this other neighbor, we had to take down this discussion, and people started talking about rats in the neighborhood, and suddenly it turned into, what was that book? I can't even remember. Lord of the Flies. Remember that, where these kids get stuck on an island and they all turn on each other? And we had to write, neighbors, what are you doing? You wouldn't talk like this to each other in person.
Right.
You wouldn't call me a libtard. You know, if we were sitting across from one another, you know, and on and on. So it's loud, great expression. You know, I mean, given where I started being interested in politics and my main source of the kind of left political information I want was a weekly newspaper. A weekly newspaper. Mm-hmm. There's been times when there's been daily left-wing newspapers in the United States, you know, not since probably the 1940s. But, I wasn't sitting around thinking, gee, I wish there was the Detroit News, rather than being arch-conservative, was, a liberal publication. I could have done without all of this. I mean, now I write, and I'm writing a lot, and I think, how the hell did I ever write on a typewriter? What did I do when I made mistakes? I mean, I know what I did. I had to cut up pieces of paper and then scotch tape them back together and sometimes just type out lines and paste those over. On the other hand, people tell me that they're being threatened online by these nefarious forces that say, we know we went online, we know exactly where you live, we know where your kids go to school and all that. And probably 999 times out of 1,000, nothing's going to happen. But it's what gives this little chill of fear to somebody.
Well, yeah, and I do think it gives people feel freer to be able to kind of be ruder or meaner online and sure. Like you said, they wouldn't do it face to face. Now, I talked to a buddy of mine recently who was always best friends with a mutual friend. And I asked him how that friend was doing. And he said that he hadn't talked to him in months because he couldn't stand his liberal views. Huh. Yet I also have a friend who the day after Trump was elected, she went on Facebook and wrote, if any of her friends voted for Trump, then to unfriend her because she can't be friends with anyone who voted for him. It's so extreme. And I just wonder, when there's so much social upheaval going on in the 60s, was there this kind of intolerance for other opinions in which you couldn't even be friends with someone who didn't share your point of view?
No. I've always either lived in predominantly African-American neighborhoods or the city I live in now is, 50% white, 50% black. So, for instance, I know the house in which every Republican lives in this whole area because, of election signs where, if it was more 50-50 or, predominantly Republican, you wouldn't. Now, I'm a regular handball player. Well, I was a regular handball player until this, although we're back playing outside again. And all these guys that I play with on the east side of Detroit are all these traditional conservative Republicans. A lot of them are, small business owners. And, some of them even don't think a lot of Trump, but there's only one thing worse than Trump, and that would have been Hillary Clinton, So you always think, Trump supporters are the most evil, awful, mean-spirited, stupid, racist people imaginable. The games are integrated. A lot of the players, these conservative guys, are involved in charities. A lot of them come down to Detroit to do stuff. And they're nice people. But guess what we never talk about, ever?
Right. Of course.
Yeah. I wore... always trying to provoke people. I often wore this T-shirt that said ITMFA, can I say any word I want?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's impeach the motherfucker already. that, and not one of them ever asked me what it stood for. One of them said, is that your union? I don't know, and don't tell me. I mean, I don't know what your politics are, but our friendship goes back far enough that even if you were, if you're a Republican, it would be like those guys. We just wouldn't talk about it. If I met somebody and they said they were a Trump supporter, I wouldn't have any interest in being friends with them in the slightest. I mean, I got enough friends. I got lots of friends. I got too many friends.
Right, new friends you're talking about.
I don't want any new friends if they support Trump. I don't even want any new friends if they support the Democrats. I got enough that fill my time. And lives in this whole area because, of election signs where, if it was more 50-50 or, predominantly Republican, you wouldn't. Now, I'm a regular handball player. Well, I was a regular handball player until this, although we're back playing outside again. And all these guys that I play with on the east side of Detroit are all these traditional conservative Republicans. A lot of them are, small business owners. And, some of them even don't think a lot of Trump, but there's only one thing worse than Trump, and that would have been Hillary Clinton, So you always think, Trump supporters are the most evil, awful, mean-spirited, stupid, racist people imaginable. The games are integrated. A lot of the players, these conservative guys, are involved in charities. A lot of them come down to Detroit to do stuff. And they're nice people. But guess what we never talk about, ever?
Right. Of course.
Yeah. I wore... always trying to provoke people. I often wore this T-shirt that said ITMFA, which that is, can I say any word I want?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's impeach the motherfucker already. and not one of them ever asked me what it stood for. One of them said, is that your union? I don't know, and don't tell me. I don't know what your politics are, but our friendship goes back far enough that even if you were, if you're a Republican, it would be like those guys. We just wouldn't talk about it. If I met somebody and they said they were a Trump supporter, I wouldn't have any interest in being friends with them in the slightest. I got enough friends. I got lots of friends. I got too many friends.
Right, new friends you're talking about.
I don't want any new friends if they support Trump. I don't even want any new friends if they support the Democrats. I got enough to fill my time.
So, Peter, you're most well known to the Riff audience as a talk show host for Riff, but you're also a rock and roll DJ, man.
Yeah.
Talk about your role at Riff as a DJ, spinning the tunes over the years.
Well, when I came into this all, it was through Dick Kernan, as we were talking earlier, and he said, hey, I can't remember why there was a slot, but there was they had weird shifts, and one began at 11 o'clock at night. He said, do you want to be a DJ? And I said, yeah. And Kernan worked the control boards and even opened the mic for me when he sat there with me whenever I interviewed people. It wasn't a phone-in talk show. It was just interviewing guests. So, and this was 1971. Yeah. I said, yeah, great. Yeah. It was it Freeform? Yeah. It was totally Freeform then. And, so okay, you can start at 11 PM. You'll go on right after Jerry Lubin. And I know Lubin, I knew Lubin well from WABX. So I go in there and he's, oh, great, man. Gave, people didn't used to give high five. They gave, I can't illustrate, can I? They would give like a sliding low five that would, wow, man.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
So I said, well, how do you do this? And he said, well, here, you put the LP on the turntable, you turn it on and it slides on this felt disc on the bottom. And you put the, explain the mechanics.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, I got to go. I said, wait a minute. What do you mean you're going? And he said, it's all yours, man. And so it would be like taking your next door neighbor, show him how to put one LP on the air and then leaving.
and then the free form part of it is really cool because you're left there and you have a room full of albums. You can play whatever you want.
You know what? That used to cause me so much stress because you were judged. That was part of the problem. We were playing for an audience of six or eight, mm-hmm. It was not as the audience, Mark, what's the name?
Hausman.
Well, yeah, any of these DJs, they're going to be listening and thinking, Jerry Lubin's going to be listening. And what if I play the wrong Stones song or what have you? But then I was there. I finally, you know, I did get the knack of it fairly well. And then there was this DJ, Barbara Holiday, who was a major piece of work. And they had put in, this playlist, and Barbara Holiday comes in drunk as can be at 11 o'clock. And I said, "Yo, Barbara, you are too drunk to go on the air. Let me stay and get to get out of here, man. I'm going to do it." She gets on the air. First words out of her mouth on commercial radio. "Oh, you motherfuckers. I'm here to kick out the motherfucking jams. And here's my pals, the MC5s, that light into that song, followed by some freeform jazz." And that was her last day.
I'm sure it was.
And she apparently went on. I was listening all the way home, and I'm thinking, is she? And it was just crazy music the entire time. And, you know, I've actually come to a point, you know, a lot of people are people that we say are too hip for the room, are contemptuous of commercial radio and playlists because, the music is so broad. Well, that's why there are MP3 players or used to be CD players or what have you. You want to hear that? Go play it. Because what it used to be, I was going to play music I thought you should listen to. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, although I think the testing is really flawed. We're playing music that pretty much people want to hear, and you can tell by the aggregate numbers of how many people are listening. And if I would be in the station, particularly WCSX, and I would hear "Take the Money and Run" by Steve Miller, if I heard it on the radio. I was listening to, say, CSX on the radio. I'd say, I can't believe they're playing it again. Because some of those songs, you probably know this better than me. I think they told me one time, "Dream On" was being played 270 times a year.
Yes, it's crazy.
But even the most avid listeners, what they call in the trade, a P1, hears it maybe 60 times.
Right.
And if they're an avid listener, they must be okay with it. But when I was in the station and I would hear "Dream On," I would find myself, and it was in the background, I would find myself rather unconsciously tapping my foot to it or appreciating it. The bad news is, in many ways, classic rock particularly has become something of a muzak. But if it soothes people at work, if it gives them memories of their youth, if it introduces young people to new music, what the hell?
You know? Right. Yeah. You know, people used to always ask me, like, you know, why do you guys play "You Shook Me All Night Long" so much? And I'd say, well, listen, go to a bar and people go to a jukebox and they put in their hard-earned money and they select "You Shook Me All Night Long." Sure. You know, people like familiar songs, and there's some sort of comfort in that for sure. But, you know, back when it was freeform radio, listeners used to turn to the DJs to get turned on to new music because you were the connection that the listener had to that music.
There was a guy that I was trying to think of his name earlier, Mark. He was a big, tall, thin DJ, worked at WABX. And he would put an album on. He'd say, "Wow, they just brought this in," and put it on. He said, "That's crap." And he'd throw it out of the window of the David Stott building downtown on like the 18th floor. I mean, it could take somebody's head off. Yeah.
So funny.
Coming up.
They fired Dick Kernan, the legend, and they said, "We got to go totally commercial." So we were playing what we want, and there was this little blip in the early 70s where that older music from the early 60s, or original rock and roll, pop music took on some cachet. So I was playing Ellie Oop by the Hollywood Argyles. You ever hear that?
I have not. No.
Google it, man.
There's a man in the funny papers we all know. He lives way back a long time ago.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911, and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
The story is this, that in case you haven't gotten a message by now, we're a new radio station, you see. And we've got new call letters. That's just a symbol of the progress we're making.
Legendary personalities from Detroit's iconic WRIF.
I think it's going to be a groovy radio station. It's going to get better.
The hipster's life is strongly influenced by jazz music. Much, if not most, of the hip vocabulary originated with jazz musicians. Isn't that right, Mr. Romo?
Yes, that's right. It's true.
Now take, for example, the riff. The conversational riff, which is a spoken counterpart of the jazz riff, which is an instrumental solo improvised around a set of chords or upon a given theme.
Oh, my.
You've had a chance, Peter, to work with a lot of just the rock and roll legendary DJs that have been in and out of Riff throughout the years. Just curious, give me your thoughts on some of them. Like, for example, Arthur P. You got a good Arthur P. story?
Arthur P., yeah. One time... after I had just bought this house, I've been living here since 1984, and the house cost $39,000. Nice little house, you know. And so Arthur had just bought a red two-seater Mercedes convertible, and I said, "What'd that cost you, Arthur?" $42,000. I said, Jesus, I said, it costs more than my house. He said, you should have bought a car. He would always say, and the other thing Arthur said, I love, he said, you know what your problem is, Werby? I said, Arthur Pennell is going to tell me my problem. I said, what do you think? He said, you only give 100%. I said, meaning? He said, I give 120% every day.
Okay. Yeah, you have to think, is that a compliment or is that a criticism? I know that you respected Drew and Mike as much as me. You got some Drew and Mike thoughts or ideas, memories?
No, I mean, when they, that cliche, the hardest working man in show business, mm-hmm. Drew Lane certainly fits that. He lives just down the street from me. And I don't know, he would get there at 4:30 in the morning. Sometimes. And yeah. I saw the show last night, so he wasn't, I mean, I don't know what he could have seen the tape of it. And I used to say, man, you two guys look like 30 miles of bad road. and they did. I think it really hurt both their health, particularly Mike's.
Sure it did.
Who passed away. And, but he was, you know, so dedicated to that. And you know, one of these personalities that just clicked in with people. I worked with Howard Stern at W4, as I said, and he was just kind of quiet in meetings. One of the things is I associate, you ready for this one? I associate morning shows with colonoscopies.
I can't imagine.
You know what I mean? I get up, and the earliest I ever get up is 8 o'clock. So if I'm listening to a morning show, man, that means I'm like going to a doctor for something. Somebody wants to stick something where the sun don't shine, you know. So I never really heard a lot of morning show, shows. But when I would go in there, I would always. It takes a lot to prepare for a daily talk show. In fact, I said earlier, I did this daily talk show for 3 years, this nationally syndicated show. And I suppose this is okay, and maybe you do this, but when I jokingly call myself a layabout, I mean, it's really kind of true. I am kind of a lazy guy, although if I told you what I was doing now, you probably wouldn't believe it. But that doing that talk show was the first thing I thought about when I got up, mm-hmm. the last thing I thought about when I went to bed, when I got up in the middle of the night I finally had to keep a pad of paper there. I would ruminate about it through the night. I was perpetually angry at the incompetent management that the UAW had hired to run this this syndicate of talk shows. And Steve Dahl was, he's a lot of these guys off air. They come super alive when the mic goes on. I mean,
yeah, it does surprise people when they find out that radio DJs who are a big personality on the air are actually introverts.
And Drew Lane, who connects with people through the warmth of his personality, is not a wild guy broadcaster.
Mm-hmm. No, not at all. Yeah.
Yeah. So he in person was, much more, like he was in person. You know, talking about the playlist, let me just quickly tell you this story. There was, I don't think about all this so much, but there was this, he was this, and is this fabled programmer. He started when he was about 17 or 18, and they hired him in at Riff. They fired Kernan. They fired Dick Kernan, the legend, and they said, we got to go totally commercial. So we were playing what we want, and there was this little blip in the early 70s where that older music from the early 60s or original rock and roll, pop music took on some cachet. So I was playing Ellie Oop by the Hollywood Argyles. You ever hear that?
I have not. No. Google it, man.
It's a funny show. Or Stranded in the Jungle. You ever hear that? I was Stranded in the Jungle. So the hotline rang. Hello. Hi, man. It's Lee Abrams. It's Lee. Yeah. Yeah, you always laugh. He said, where'd you get that song you're playing? I said, what do you think? I was hearing the show. He said, okay, man, great show. He comes in and walks out with half the albums in the studio. Actually, they hadn't put in a playlist then, but they wanted to make sure that that the Hollywood Argyles didn't make it onto Riff again.
Well, yeah, and Lee was one of the architects of program radio. I mean, He had that vision, and he kind of began it at the Riff.
I never knew stations were rated when I started. Hmm. I had no idea. I thought you just did it and people were cool and, people told you, yeah, ABX is cool, And that was it. And everybody you knew listened to ABX. That which is interesting, by the way, when I've told people that the public radio station in Detroit, WDET, is like 22nd in the market, and they go, what? That's impossible. Everybody I know listens to WDET. I go, right.
Yeah.
Everyone you know. And it does not extend very far beyond that. Talk about being in bubbles. I mean, WDET does a good job in what it does.
Sure. But,
I mean, these stations, as Tom Bender, the general manager, one time said, we are not a family. Although we are sometimes friends and close, we are a business, mm-hmm. and we are here to make a profit. And we make a profit by having as high a rating as possible. And what he didn't say is if playing Ellie Oop by the Hollywood Argyles three times an hour brought a listenership, we'd be doing that.
Right.
Why not? I mean, I don't fault him. I never.
No, not at all. I mean,
I never objected one bit. I mean, people every once in a while would say, I can't believe it. You never go out of format. Interrupts my reading. If I have to start thinking of my own music. But I believe them. I actually believed in the program. Sometimes they were wrong. I remember being a couple of times at stations. Riff did this thing where they were going kind of mushy rock and roll. I can't even think of who they were playing. But they had this television ad where they showed all these albums like AC/DC being thrown in the trash.
Throw away the heavy metal.
Yes, I've never seen such an idiotic, if they were going to do it.
Right, yeah.
Another time on W4 under Jerry Lubin, we got into somewhat fusion, rock and roll, and that was a disaster. But they said, play that? I played it. It's their deal. When it went down, they went down. I didn't go down. It wasn't because I was playing, Ellie Oop. It was because they told us to play, Bad Leroy Brown.
I do know that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as Riff is, it's approaching its 50th anniversary, and it's one of the few commercial radio stations that has maintained the same format for 50 years. What do you suppose it is, Peter, about the Riff that has made it so endearing to its listeners and the people of Detroit for so long?
Well, it's the personalities, of course, and you always think there's never going to be another Arthur P., and there never will be. You know, Steve Costan and Ann Carlini and you and maybe me, but it's partly the music. There's been genius of programming, Doug Podell, and the last guy,
Mark Pennington.
Mark Pennington. Sorry, Mark, if you're listening. Just had a little brain fart here. And there were some blips that they made some mistakes, but they always came back, on their feet. You know, Michael Mayer. Michael Mayer was the PD. Were you there when he was the program director?
I was there when he was doing sales.
Yeah, well, he's a great salesman. Yeah, he wasn't a bad program director, but his desk would be covered an inch thick. And the same with Joey Urbiel, who was another program director. And they worked their butts off. And particularly Michael would put out 4 memos a day, just so you couldn't say, I didn't know I was supposed to do that. You know, Mark Pazman, the great friend and a terrific blues player, became the program director. And so I'd go into his office. You could absolutely clean, not a paper on it. And he's got his electric guitar. He said, who's this man? Who does this? And I said, ZZ Top. He said, you're guessing. Come on, let me do it again. And I don't know if I remembered it or not. And he'd say, let's go to lunch. And I'd go, yeah.
We're off.
It didn't seem to have any less success under him. But for some reason, I don't even know why, there was why they switched program director. I never paid any attention. There was Mark Pennington too? He was he was a program director. You were never a program director, were you?
Nope, never program director.
And Tom Bender was a program director.
So yeah, early on.
And so the people say Detroit's like a small town, and it could be, in fairness, although we have African American listeners, it's mostly a station that plays white rock and roll. That that goes out to mostly a non internal migration white youth population, and that go, that is to say, middle class and upper class people. Oh, I'm moving to California. I'm moving to New York. I'm moving. Most of the people here, like in the suburb where I live, people take pride in. Yeah, my father lives down. Down the street and what have you. So this is our stage, one of our stage, maybe the single, I ended my career with WCSX, although the talk show is still on RIP, but people have intense loyalty to WRI because it's our hometown station. I think that's a lot of it. And I try to listen to some of the other stations on the air, and I think, who are these people that are on the air, and what is that music they're playing?
I always said that music sounded better on the riff for some reason.
I'm real busy. When people say they retire and they have nothing to do, I have more to do now than I think before when I was working.
Yeah. So Night Call ended in 2016. What are you doing? What have you been doing?
Well, for one thing, I'm just finishing up. I'm just thinking of the best word for it, fictionalized memoir, mostly that just takes place in 1967, that takes into account the riots. It's a lot about violence, because those were, very violent times, to be sure. And that's taken a lot of work, and probably more. I think about it, sometimes, unless you have a really big seller, if you sell 2,000 copies of a novel, you're not doing too badly. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, you click on the riff, you open the mic on a riff, and there's thousands and thousands of people listening. And this is, I finished a first draft, and I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, is this good enough to publish? And a friend of mine who's, a published author said, it's called Your Shitty First Draft.
Uh-huh.
You're probably going to have to go through it another 6 times. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have to read 320 page books 6 times. I'm going to go out of my mind. So that's taking a lot of time. I still write for the Fifth Estate magazine now, that instead of a weekly paper as it was, now comes out 3 times a year. play handball a lot, active in my community, do some gardening. And
yeah, Peter, for the longest time, you didn't like to share your age, but I read an article that you did in the Metro Times recently, and it kind of sounds like you're okay with it now.
Wait, really? Wait, I did? No. This is the 11th. In eight days, Juneteenth, I'll be 80 years old.
That is absolutely amazing. And I think I speak for anyone who knows you or who has ever known you. You have aged better than anyone we've ever known in our entire lives. Well, what is your secret?
All right. Think it's an accident of genes, for one thing. You know, mm-hmm. You never know what card's turning over at any age. So never had any kids. And that's most parents will laugh when you say that. Are you a parent?
Oh, yeah.
So you go.
It ages you.
You kind of roll your eye. But I think it is. I mean, kids is, you know, and sometimes I feel badly that my wife and I never had children. And, you know, this would be a point where I'd have grandchildren or great-grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And as much as you love them, they do cause stress and sometimes unhappiness and disappointment and all that. So, you know, that's gone. And this probably could even rankle some of the hardworking people that are listening to this. I never worked real hard in my life. And I'll tell you, being born, if I would have, if I would have behaved in life when I was born, when you are, I'd be on Skid Row. Right. Mm-hmm. But because of an accident of time, that's what I said, I wound up on my feet, financially stable. You know, like right now, there's not a union at WRIF. Then there was. Besides getting Social Security, I get a union pension for all my layabout ways. And also, the most important thing about aging, I think, is just stay in denial as long as you can. Act like you want to be. If you want to be, you can be silly. I'm not going to act like I'm 25. I don't have a little sports car and, going out with 30-year-olds. What I mean is, you know, play handball or play tennis or, mm-hmm. you know, go to the gym. Take care of yourself, you know, your diet and what have you. And, you can extend life. And besides, I was going to have a big 80th birthday party. Of course, that's off. So you guys are invited to my 90th.
I'm sure you'll look exactly the same.
Well,
hey, Peter, how do you want to be remembered?
Oh, my God. I don't know. What? That? No, here, we're going to have to get Steve to edit out all this silence and umming. And I don't know. Someone who acted ethically in the world that tried to make the world better, kinder, more loving. I said earlier that I heard a speech by Martin Luther King Jr., and he had this concept called the beloved community, and that's one where you don't yell at people, and you that there's a place for everybody, and you it's filled with compassion, and even some tolerance for difference, and not the desire for power over people. I mean that takes a revolution, though,
yeah.
At least in attitudes. But, you know, we can be that. We can, you know, start with each of us.
Amen, brother. Okay. Hey, Peter, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have known you all these years, almost 30 years. And I've really been looking forward to this conversation. So thanks for joining us on the podcast.
You haven't aged much either.
Thank you. I'm in denial, too. I'm thinking young and acting young.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.